It's exactly 8:30. It's time to begin. We stay on time around here. Some of you have asked about a number of things. Let me just go through a couple of books here. This is the one that I suggest you might look at if you want to read something a little heavier than what I say here on the subject. It's a book called that I wrote on Genesis 3, which caused some stir in our church and may be of interest to you if you want to be stirred by theology. And it's available in the Hike House. I think there's still some left. I don't know for sure, but I believe so. And it deals with the whole question from a more scholarly vantage point. Any of you who are above high school age ought to be able to understand it. Then, form and meaning of the fall narrative. That's Genesis 3. That's what it means. Form and meaning of the fall narrative. The green book with the snake on the front. You can't remember the title. All right? Then, by chance, maybe it's not by chance, shouldn't say that, I suppose. Cal Stoley gave his devotions last night on Psalm 8, which I shall use, which is an integral part of this lecture, such presentation, and I'll indicate why it's important a little bit later on. But also, I have a Christmas program based upon Psalm 8 called The Visit of God. This is the first thing that I ever wrote publicly. And still fairly good. No. It's amazing. I look at it and I say, well, it's amazing what I could write back then, 4 years ago. And this is based on Psalm 8, and it is sort of semi-dramatic. It is also available on tape from radio station KFUO at the seminary in St. Louis. It's supposed to be a bibliography of all this stuff. I'll mention it to you and we'll see if we can get it run off so you can have a copy. But this is tied up exactly with what we had last night, but in simple form. Children can use it also. The tape with a professional choir has done this, and it's available for you if you're interested. Then, this one is the Waltha League thing that I wrote, youth thing for teenagers primarily. It's a little, some people like it for adult work too, because it asks the same basic questions, but slightly different words here and there. It's called Wait a Minute, Moses. Stop the train, I want to get off. And it's available from Concordia Publishing House. There's another one that's going to follow up on this called Are You Joking, Jeremiah? We did one of these devotions a couple of weeks ago. Right? For that publicity, you get a free copy. And then there's one other little thing that it's just done by the print shop at the seminary called My Words in Your Mouth, which is some experimental worship materials from Jeremiah. Was used, first of all, at Pacific Lutheran University and caused some reaction. Some hated it, some liked it. So if you're interested in something like this, so just a variety of stuff, you could look at it and see whether you're interested. It's poetry plus dialogue plus litany, etc. And it's a little higher than, it's sort of college level at least. The words are taken from Jeremiah, In My Words in Your Mouth. All right, so much for that. And then again, let me repeat that other book that I mentioned for you. If you're interested, this is your level, especially designed for laymen who have had some biblical background, called How the World Began by Thielicke. And Thielicke, I guess, is one of the greatest preachers in Germany today. And you can understand him. He talks to you, even though it's Old Testament often. Or his New Testament works, too, are very good. Now, let me see, any other new people today? New people who were not here yesterday? Okay, that's great. For those people who were not here yesterday, I am Doc Harble, sometimes called Uncle Norm, sometimes called Jeremiah, sometimes called other worse names. And you will gradually get to feel what we're doing. What we did yesterday was to... Well, you can see it all on the board. Very simple. And I'm sure it would be impossible to summarize. What we did, first of all, was to ask the question from the group, what are the different kinds of literature that you've heard of? And we had all of those,
plus a whole batch on this side which have now been erased because we don't have a long enough blackboard in this place. Sometime they'll put a decent one up in here for lectures. That's a Stahican project for next year, remember that. Then we also had asked the question, we started off on Genesis 1, what kind of literature is Genesis? How does that fit into the picture? And basically we came out with, we said that the Genesis itself calls this literature family traditions. That's its name for them, the 10 family traditions. And then we had to ask, well, what does it mean by the family traditions? And at least some of the dimensions of what it meant, we found, were that it involved polemic, it involved, to some extent, also some theology, since it talked about the question of origins and ultimates, and perhaps a number of other things. But at least these two things we found were involved in Genesis 1. And so we are not dealing with a documentary chronicle, which simply gives you an eyewitness account. We didn't have any eyewitnesses for that event. So we are dealing with a polemic, and we asked the question, or we actually decided this after we had asked this question, what are some of the possible backgrounds where we could see this, the reason for this polemic? And we talked about what was one of the major ideas about creation, or the major, what we call myths about creation that were floating around back in the days of the Israelites. And we talked about the story of the battle between the two gods, the good god Marduk, who was the god of vegetation, life, and the storm, and the evil god, the god of the seas, the water god, the god of the waters, always depicted as a dragon, sea monster of some sort, whose name was Tiamat. And in this battle, Marduk won the battle, sliced Tiamat in half, flipped one half up and got heaven, flipped the other half down and got earth. And when we looked at Genesis, I had to tell you, because the English doesn't tell you, but the word for deep, which we found in Genesis 1 verse 2, is the same word as the word Tiamat. And what we made saw apparent was that the writer of Genesis 1 was very much concerned about saying the world is not evil at all, but it is good. All the way down the line, he keeps saying, and it was very good, very good, very good. We found that he was saying that Tiamat is not a chaos monster that God has to fight, but God's spirit is controlling it from the very beginning. And God ordered this simply by his will. And that the battle between the gods was not there, as it is in all of the other creation stories in ancient world. The battle between the gods is the way that creation came about. And that this battle is repeated every year in what we call the myth. Myth, we said, was not just the fanciful creation of the mind, but was the ancient people's way of trying to understand what was happening every year in the world of nature. That around him there were all these forces of life, and the only way he could understand them was to talk about them in terms of wills, gods, beings. And so his world was full of gods. Inevitably, every time something moved in the sky or in nature, it was a god at work. He had no other way of understanding it. So this has to be all kept in mind. This is what we talked about yesterday in this kind of background. I know I'm skimming it for the new people, but we can't spend time repeating it all completely. And what we did then was to look at Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. That's as far as we got then. And this is what we found in Genesis 1, verse 2. Genesis 1:1, we generally decided, maybe not universally, but generally, Genesis 1:1 was an introduction, which simply stated God made the heavens and the earth. And then, with each time it says, and God said, you've got an act of creation. And God said, and this happens 10 times. Just as the number 10 was a symbolic number all through the book of Genesis. It's used many times in this way to fix up schemes and arrangements. And then, we looked at Genesis 1 verse 2, and we said, what was there? We found that there was darkness. We found that there was formlessness, void or chaos. We found that the Spirit of God was there, and we found that the name for this whole thing was the deep. That is the same name as this god of chaos and the god of the waters, the sea monster, the dragon of the stories of creation around, the Babylonian story especially. All right, briefly summarizing, that's where we got. Were there any questions now, just so that something that essentially you think we missed, so that the people who are coming in can get it? My summaries are often very sketchy. I don't want to spend a lot of time. All right. Now, what happens? We move next into chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, the first day of creation. What happens on the first day of creation? All right? It's very easy. Now, another little thing I want to tell you. Anybody and everybody in this room, some people are afraid to answer, you know, a question because they're afraid to be wrong. And I always like to tell people in my Bible study things that I say, please display your ignorance. Nobody can ever help you unless you do. Don't be afraid to make a wrong answer. If you knew how many wrong answers I made in my life, you'd say I deserve to be back in the penitentiary somewhere instead of where I am. Don't be afraid to make wrong answers, because it doesn't make a scrap of difference whether you're right or wrong, so long as you get straightened out in the end. Now I had an eraser. Did you swallow the eraser, Laurel? Huh? What happened to the eraser?
I moved it, right?
You moved it. Hmm. Where did you move it, dear? Somebody have a handkerchief they don't want? Huh? How could that be?
Here it is.
Only that. All right, if we are all finished now, we can move this stuff that's on the board. Normally I like to keep it because I kept it. I should refer back to it, but because we don't have a lot of blackboards, Daryl, we'll operate. We'll have to erase it. All right. Put it down again. Setting that we had was chaos. Verses 1 and 2. In the beginning God created everything, and the world was chaos, waters and all the rest of it. That's the setting. Now comes the first act of creation. What happens? What does God create? Very simply.
Light.
Light. Right, that's very easy. Now what does he call that light? Day. Hmm. Well, does day and that point then mean the same thing as 24 hours? Light is day, and darkness is night. It's a kind of interesting thing. We have light and dark being called day and night. So we're using day in a sense that's a very interesting sense. Day in the kind of poetic sense of meaning that which is light means day. Means that part where everything happens. Can you tell me anything else about what the word light means in the Bible? When you say, let there be light, even when you're in your own conversation sometimes, you don't always mean just, I want the lights turned on.
Understanding.
Understanding?
Knowledge?
Knowledge?
Wisdom?
Wisdom?
Righteousness.
Yeah, that's a little bit more obtuse, yeah. But now, let's go back in the Old Testament. When the Old Testament brought light in, what was, he is the light and my, he is the, my light and my salvation?
Peter.
My light and my salvation. Does light mean just knowledge there? Does it mean something more?
God.
Yeah. Goodness, part of it. One more word I want that really is tied up with this. Yes.
Direction.
Direction. All these things are part of a bigger total. Huh?
Light.
Life, right. Yeah. Light is one of the key symbols of life in the Old Testament. So when you say, let there be light, there was in the mind of the Old Testament writer and Israelite listener something more than just the flickering of beams somewhere. It is specifically also involves the source of life. That which means warmth and a whole lot of other things as well. So God brings this in on the first day. Light, which he calls day, strangely. And that always fascinates me. And I've still never been quite sure why this is. There must be a reason, I think, because I think the reason is this. That there were also two gods. One is called day and one was called night in the ancient world. Now I can't be sure that this is exactly what is the reason here, because we don't have quite enough evidence. But there's a very definite reason, it seems to me, in terms of the ancient world, why he would say that God creates light and life first of all, and that he is the source of it all. that there was not a life in the sense of there were gods who were alive beforehand. But God starts it off with his process of life. Now he makes light, you see, long before he makes sun or moon or stars or anything else. That comes first. And that's a fascinating thing, too. So that light, the source of life and everything else, you see, is from God. It's independent of all these beings, these suns and moons and stars and things that people worshipped as gods. It's independent of those. It belongs only to the one God. And all of this is part of the polemic. You see, part of the push to say, look, there's one God, and he made the light, and that's the way it starts. All right? Then he says, it was morning and evening, one day. Now, I have a feeling that day means a little bit different thing in verse 5 when he says one day than when he said he called the light day. Looks like already we've got two different meanings for the word day in the same verse. It's kind of interesting. One is light, and the other one is morning and evening. Another fascinating thing is that morning and evening were also the names for two gods in the ancient world. The morning star and evening star are the two gods that rise every day. Shachar and Shalom, they're called. And, well, I happened to read a little bit about them. There was a rite, a ritual connected with these gods that the Israelites knew as well. Well, we won't spend time on it. But, you know, it's all the background. These things have special meanings and connotations that are completely lost to you and me because we just read it with our word day, with our word evening. Those words had lots of loaded overtones when you listen to them as an Israelite sitting there in the midst of all of these stories. Our stories are Alice in Wonderland. Their stories were Tiamat and Marduk. And they were not just stories. They were part of the worship. They were rituals. All right. First day, then, God creates light. Second day, God said, let there be... Well, what did he make? Firmament. Now, who can tell me, in terms of the text, what the firmament is? Let there be a firmament. Where? Where? In the midst of what? The waters. All right, let's follow our diagram through. Here are the waters. Now, where are we going to put the firmament? We've got light coming in somewhere. Now, we're going to put the firmament in the midst of the waters. All right, let's put it in here. There it is. The firmament in the midst of the waters. And when we talk about firmament, what does the word firmament suggest by the very word itself? Something that is? Something that is solid or firm, right? The word firm in and of itself helps. So firmament is being something that's firm. In other words, and it's also got to do this. Namely, it's got to divide the waters from the waters. And you can't divide waters normally unless you have something, in the mind at least of those people, unless you have something solid. This is the way you divide one lot of water from the next. You put a pot or a piece of board between the waters and you'll split them up. So here we're going to have this thing divide the waters from the waters. All right, is that clear? That's exactly what it says. Now, I'm not doing anything else but putting on the board the diagram of what's in here. Or don't you agree? Have I done something else? Have I added anything than what the text says?
There's something strange here, and he called the firmament heaven.
All right, he called the firmament heaven, so we've got a name for it. The firmament is called heaven. Why is that strange? Why is that strange? Here's a firmament. It's a solid thing called heaven. Is there any problem with that? For the Israelite who's sitting there and he says, well, on the first day there had to be light so God could see what he was doing. For some other reason, to bring life into the world. And he looks up at the sky, and he says, well, that's obviously some sort of ceiling up there, because those things up there, those stars don't fall down. See? How can they be up there? And why is it blue anyway? Why is it blue? Well, the logical thing is to make something, if something's blue, it's tied up with the color of water. And may very well be that he thinks that this is covered with water on top. You say, well,
water on top of the sky up there? Why shouldn't he think it's solid anyway? It doesn't fall down. Stars don't hang in it. Things don't hang in air. He doesn't know anything about the law of rotation or gravity in the space sense. So he looks at it and he says, there's a sky. Those things are stuck up there like things on a pinboard and still there. Why should it fall down? It must be solid. So we've got a solid thing up there. And then he says there's waters on top of it. What would be the sense of saying there are waters on top of the sky? Huh? Does it make any sense to you? It may not. But what is it to him? Yeah, the whole business about cloud bursts and all the rest. Sure, he's aware, too, in other places that there are clouds underneath it. When we talk about the great cloud bursts, when the waters come down. Let me turn you to another passage so that this is made quite clear to you. What happened in the story? Well, I'll go one other step further. The waters below are still down here. Do we have any reason to believe there would be waters below the heavens? Or even below the earth? Sure, fountains come up. How can you explain fountains? There's got to be water down there. How can you explain the sea? There's got to be water. There's water all around us and there's water coming up through the ground. There's got to be water everywhere else, excepting where I'm standing. Water comes from up there. You can only explain this if you're looking around you in logical, simple terms, as though there's water everywhere. And the sky stops the water from coming down up this way, and the earth stops it from coming up this way. That's his way of thinking about it. Let me just point you to another passage to help you understand this. This is his, to him talking now. Not the scientist, but the man who's listening then. It's in Genesis chapter 7. When the story of the flood comes, what happens in the story of the flood? Huh? The mountains are broken? All right, the fountains of the earth, first of all, break open, and what comes up? Let me give you the verses so you can follow it. Verses 11 and following, I think. Yes. In the 600th year of the life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the 11th hour at 6:45 a.m., on that day, all the fountains of the what? What was the deep? Remember the deep yesterday? All those great waters. All the fountains of the deep, that thing that we were talking about yesterday, they all broke open. So if the deep breaks open, what's happening? Huh? Well, the water comes back and goes back to the chaos again, goes back to the water again that we had way back when. The fountains break open, and then what else happens? The wind is of heaven. So we open up the heaven here. It's hard to draw anything anymore. And down comes the rain, the waters, the fountain, the waters pour in because the windows of the heaven, and you're going to have windows up there, you're going to have something sort of solid to stick windows in. The windows move in, open and the water moves in. The deep opens up and the waters come back. So you have the waters above the heavens and the waters below the heavens all coming back into one great chaos again. Right? There it is. So the flood story is really not just a little bit of a sprinkle at all. It's a total convulsion of nature. See? And the thing lasts for a whole year, you realize. A 12-month period. And it's fascinating that the dry land comes back on what day? I bet nobody in this room knows. New Year's Day. And on New Year's Day, there is no life. The land is there again. We start all over again. New Year's Day. And it's not uninteresting that these stories about creation were always repeated in the worship services of Babylon on New Year's Day, or of Canaan. These were New Year's Day rites and rituals. So you have all of these connections with what was going on in the world around Israel. So, anyway. Now let's go back. So God puts this firmament, that solid thing. Now, how many of you believe that the sky is solid? You? Why don't you?
We've been taught that it isn't.
You've been taught that there isn't? There's more than that. You've gone up there, and you've come back again, and you didn't bump your head. Or the rocket, right? Simple as that. Through experience, you've discovered that it isn't that way. And yet, this man is operating with the sky as being solid, as did everybody else in that ancient world. The Babylonians, the Canaanites, the Hittites, Perizzites, the Girgashites, you know, the whole bang lot. They all operated with the picture of the sky as solid. Why shouldn't they? How could they think anything else? All those things, they stayed up there. See, excepting the rain. That was what came down. The stars didn't. And so, from simple observation of nature, they describe God's creation in terms of, first of all, God makes a ceiling. That's the first thing he makes. And it divides the waters up there that are on top from the waters below. And all of the peoples of the ancient world believed that. You remember the story of Marduk? The dragon was a watery chaos figure. Waters. He threw one half up. The waters up there. One half down. Heaven and earth. See? The background is very similar. All right. So he's moving in this picture where he calls this heaven. Now, let's go one... Oh, that must be my watch. You know, heaven doesn't have any face on it. I mean, it has a face, but it has no mask on it. That's a dig. All right. Cut my finger, too. Ever been cut by time? All right. Now, this is heaven. That's another thing to note. This is heaven. And nobody in the Old Testament ever dreams when he dies that he's going to go to heaven, to be up there in those waters. There's never a place where anybody in all the Psalms or any place that you can mention ever says, I will, when I die, I will go to heaven. Because there is no such concept in the Old Testament. At all. When he dies, he goes where everybody else goes, to a special little location in the middle of the deep here, called Sheol. We talked about that last week, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But just so that you realize what heaven is when they're talking about it, is this thing up here. And God sort of has a location on the corner over here, on the corner of the mountains, top of the mountains, the corner of heaven. But man never goes there. One special incident was when Elijah was taken up into the sky. But that's kind of an abnormal thing because he was special. Nobody else gets that privilege. All right, unless you're a Negro spiritual singer, then you get it. This is not New Testament talking, this is Old Testament. And remember, we're still saying the Old Testament is a big question mark often in some things that the New Testament answers. Now, what happens next on the third day then? First of all, we divide the waters from the waters. What's next? Then God says what? What next? What happens next? What does that mean? Well, it puts all these waters that are here, he doesn't let them fly all over the place, right? So he puts, that's right, dearie, he puts them in one place. Let's pull them to the side here. Pull all the waters to one place here. And after he pulled all the waters to one place, what then? Huh? The dry land appeared. So then, suddenly, the dry land appears. I made it like that for a very special reason, with a peak like that. Do you know why the pyramid in Egypt is shaped like a pyramid? Why they use the pyramid concept? What is a pyramid? The pyramid is a stone replica of the first peak of earth that comes out of the wall at creation. And God, the God of Egypt, when he saw this peak of land coming out of the water, said, that's where I'd like to sit and observe the rest of creation. And that little peak becomes that peak, that first primeval hill, that first hill in creation, is this place where the temple was built. And each of the temples of Egypt claims to be on the primeval hill. They're all on the same primeval hill. You don't have any idea of different space. Space kind of coalesces in the ancient world, but there it is. And so now the same sort of picture. Here are the waters, and out of the waters comes a hill. I let the dry land appear, come to appear right from the midst of it all. And so God creates it. Now again, let me pick up a couple of things. For the Israelite, for the people around Israel, the sky was a god. You spell it with a capital S.
The earth was a god with a capital E. The waters were, you know, we had the waters as a goddess. All of these things were deities. They were gods, you see. And now suddenly, these are not born from one god. See, the sky god is supposed to have intercourse with the water god, and you produce earth, or something like this. Now suddenly, every one of these happens not by the process of biological connections between the gods, but simply by God saying, let there be. Let there be, purely by the will of one God. This is unbelievable. If you lived in a world where everybody else assumed that there were all sorts of other gods, and that all of these things came to be through the sexual relations of other deities, or other kind of activities, they formed them somehow. And then suddenly you have somebody coming along and say, no, there's only one God, and this one God says, let there be, and all these things happen, bip, 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 down the line. I'll say, you're nuts. It's impossible. Why? It's just inconceivable. This is a fantastic leap. A leap of faith. That the people who were believing, and most of them often still did, believed, at least all the people around believed, that these were gods and these things were tied to gods. Suddenly saying now, no, they are not gods. You take the myth out of them, that is. What's the big word we use for that? When you take the myth out of something, say no longer it is tied up to a god. You demythologize. It's a huge word that the scholars like to throw around and throw dust in people's eyes. You know? All it means is that what used to be thought of in terms of God or supernatural, you take that part out. And so what the Israelites did that right from the very beginning. Chapter 1 is demythologizing. That is, taking the gods out of things that everybody else thought was tied up to God. Namely, sky, the earth, every solitary bit of this. And we'll get this even more as we go down the line. All right, so he makes the dry land. He pulled the waters together and he called those sea. And this he calls earth. And then he puts some grass on it, some trees, vegetation. Two acts of creation on the third day, then. Earth and vegetation. All right, now on the fourth day, what happens?
Sun, moon, and stars.
Right, sun, moon, stars. And these are not accidental either. These are tied up with the first day. And just the same pattern that we had the other day, let's make sure it's clear. The first day corresponds with the fourth, the second with the fifth, and the third with the sixth. These are very carefully structured arrangements. So the first day we created light, the fourth day we create that which carries the light bearers. Now did he say sun and moon? You said sun and moon. Is he right? Read it. Does it say sun and moon? What does it say? The greater light and the lesser light. I wonder why he doesn't say sun and moon in this case. Well, sun and moon were just like saying, let's find a modern equivalent. If I were to say, and God created all of the baskets. Not a very nice word, is it? I'm using an illustration here. And so if I use that word, you know, you'd say, yeah. But if that word had another connotation, not simply being an ugly word, but was also the name of a deity, as well as being an ugly word, then you would be very happy to avoid it. So what he's saying here, he's going even further in his polemic against these things and saying, look, no, God didn't. God made these things. The sun and the moon are not the father of all these other gods. The sun god, you see, was often conceived of as the father of all these other things that came into being. So he even avoids the name of these two figures and says the greater light and the lesser light, using a nice little bit of poetry, rather than a straight-out statement of the creation. Let there be sun. Let there be a greater light and a lesser light. And so we keep this thing going, where he's all the time talking over against in relationship to that problem. And now the leap of faith has to be made by any Israelite who reads this has to say, no, that is not a god, that is something God made. Only one God made it. You've only got one God in this story. And that's the phenomenal. There is no other creation story in the ancient world that has only got one God in it. They've all got lots of gods. There are battles between the gods.
All right. Let's take the next day, the last fifth day. On the fifth day, God creates what? Fish and the birds. Now notice, what we had on the second day was a firmament, that's the sky, and we had waters. That's what all we had on the second day. The first day we had light, and then the fourth day we created the things to carry the light, the sun and the moon. The fifth day we got fish and birds. The fish and birds obviously fit into the sky, which is made on the second day, and the waters which were left behind. So the things to live in the sky and the waters. One little thing. God didn't just say, let there be fish and let there be birds. The writer added one very specific kind of animal. He didn't have to. Why did he bother to add one specific kind of animal? What animal is it? Sea monster. He could have just said, let there be fish and let there be birds. But he puts, let there be sea monster. Why? Why? Well, here they are. See? They didn't just happen to be. He made them. Anything you think is a sea monster is not a god at all. He goes to the trouble of putting in precisely that word. And the word here, I'll give you the name for it, is Tanin. A word which in Canaan is the name of a god, you see. Is the name of specifically the monster that is the same as Tiamat in Babylon. He is carefully saying, God made also these things. Now there's another place where the writer, in Psalm 104. How many of you read that by chance? Psalm 104. Who's read it? Sometime. I'm sure you've read it. Yeah, you must have. In church, anyway. And at one point, in Psalm 104, God says, and God made Leviathan, another name for the sea monster is Leviathan. Leviathan is the sea monster, it's not the devil. God made Leviathan, what? In order that he might be afraid of him? To fight with him? No. And here's the fun thing. He made the sea monster, Leviathan, to play with. That's God's beach ball. It's God's beach ball. The sea monster. And this always fascinated me.
You see, when you come along with simply a simple listing of things like this, and suddenly you add one thing that sticks out like a sore thumb, namely the sea monster. And how many of you have seen sea monsters anyway? This is a strange thing. You've seen sea monsters? Good for you. Watch them. All right. Is it clear to you now? The interesting type of thing where he is carefully working out this polemic all the way down the line. I don't want to write it too hard, but it's very important. All right, then comes the last day. And on the last day, God makes very explicitly animals and man. All right? And this corresponds exactly to the third day, namely the beings to inhabit the earth. So the first day, the beings or things to inhabit the sky, to carry the light and the sun and moon. The second day, the beings to inhabit the firmament and the waters. And the fourth day, third day, corresponds to the sixth, the animals to inhabit the earth. All right? Yes?
How did the ancient people understand that birds were able to
fly
in the heavens?
Well, they knew that there was a certain measure of vacuum. But once you get up there, you know, with those big things called sun and moon that were just hanging there, and obviously were not flying, you know, how did you get around that? Surely they understood a certain amount of space. You know, you can go like this. There's a gap there. There's nothing there. They didn't understand the concept of air as we did, obviously. But these things were things that they could just observe within the range of observation. This is an ordering of what they could see. It's a very logical ordering, isn't it? From thought, you could come up with that by just observing things. And it's the same kind of logic, simple logic, that was true of the ancient world. All right.
Any other questions at this point? I'm going to talk about the creation of man a little bit later on, but we want to work on this for a moment yet. Now, I'm going to do a couple of other things to make this, see whether this is understandable. Pick up all of this stuff that we've been talking about. First of all, in connection with the waters above the heavens was their understanding of rain and cloudbursts and all the rest of it. Then the firmament, which we had, was their understanding of what we would call space, right? We would talk about a meteorological process there. They would talk about waters above the heaven. And they understood it in terms of waters up there. This wasn't a symbol for air or moisture or something else. This is what they knew, they thought, because they lived then. Firmament is what we would call space. The sun, right, is what they called the great light, the greater light. We call this a light, simply up in the sky. And we can go right down the list here of all these different things about the waters below the heavens and the waters above the heavens and the firmament. The mountains, if you look elsewhere, the mountains are their way of talking about the structure at the end of the sky that holds up the thing. This is the structure of the universe. And so you can go down the line, and you have to say, suddenly, seems as though the writer is writing from his world. And this is his worldview, this is his way of seeing things, and this is so he describes them that way. And it's the same way that everybody thought in the ancient world. Well, the heavens here, the waters up there, the earth here, and the waters below it. That's their picture. And why should we say, try and get away from it? If everybody thought that way, that's a simple way of thinking. Now, what would you say to that man who said that? You're wrong. Would you say to that man who was telling the story, you're wrong? That's not solid firmament. There aren't waters hanging above there. Would you say to him, he's wrong? Huh? All right. All right, what's our frame of reference? If I come to this from the frame of reference of a scientist, what will I say? Doesn't work. But if I come to this from the frame of reference and say, all right, I am coming to this story not to ask the questions of a scientist. Since this man was not talking about science, he was talking about the problem of faith in a world where everybody believed in gods. This was a question of a great leap of faith to believe that everything that people could see and know around them was made by God and was not the product of the conflict of other gods. Now this is the question he's talking to. He's not talking to the question of how the geology of the earth came about, the age of the earth, and all those questions. He has a polemic and a problem that he's got to face. And so he talks about the things that they know, namely that thing up there, the sun. He talks about the things that they know, namely that thing that he calls the greater light, the sea dragon. He talks about things that are understandable to them. And so if I were to have a little kid and I suddenly started to talk about an automobile, I wouldn't go into the intricacies of electricity. I would talk about things in terms that he understood, the things that he could see and touch and were understandable. And so, when God is talking through this writer, he uses whatever they knew and could see then. And so they are trying to fight the battle of saying, these are not gods, but this is simply one God who made everything that you can see and everything that you've learned about the world. He wasn't giving them a lesson in science. He was giving them a lesson in faith. And this is a big leap of faith that the people have to make, not a leap of science. And if you suddenly come to this text now and say, I'm going to make this guy a scientist in Genesis 1, you ain't fair to him at all, because he's not a scientist. He's a theologian, he's a poet, he's a man who's fighting a battle for the people of his world.
So when a scholar comes to me and he says, you know, I can, everything that is in Genesis 1 is exactly according to the sequence of science, and I can harmonize everything with science, I'm saying to you, friend, you're not doing what the writer wants you to do. He wants you to listen on his terms, in his world, to his problem. And that is the question of faith, about God making all these things. Not the question, the scientific question of how. And none of you believes that the sky is a solid firmament anyway. You all make the adjustment. But if you're going to read the story in his terms, then you've got to sit there and listen to him as he fights his battle. And don't put him on the pedestal of a 20th century scientist. All right? Is there any problem with that realization, with that question? There may be a tremendous conflict in terms of science, but this man's not talking science. But you would never tell a poet like this wonderful poem about the waterfall. Lyte is full of spray and a few other things there. You wouldn't ask a scientist to read that as a scientist. He has to read it as a poet. So you cannot ask a person to be a scientist when he's reading Genesis 1. Because the whole thing we've talked about is not according to that. It's not the language of maths. It's the language of poetry and theology and polemic. All right, that's enough, really. That's what I said enough. Any questions at this point? Yes?
Do you think that because of the different traditions and ways, is there anything that we have so many different thoughts to lead into writing to a story?
I didn't get your point, I'm sorry.
So, like, for instance, a poet can understand things in a poetry way, and a scientist understands things in a poetry way.
Oh, to read into Scripture? Well, what I'm trying to say is you've got to sit where this man sits and understand it where he is. And don't try and read something into it. And this is why scientists, if people come as a scientist and try to read science in this, they are doing an injustice to the writer who never intended it that way. And if anybody takes my purple puzzle and wants to make that a scientific document, then, of course, they're foolish. I'm writing poetry for children. I'm not writing a scientific document. The theological truths about God creating it and doing it and all the rest of it are valid because it's theology. It's poetry. But it is not science. See, and so I take the pieces of poetry and I build them. I exaggerate them, sure. But that's because I'm not writing science. I'm not thereby destroying the truth, the basic truth that's behind it. All right, yes.
Yesterday, when we were exploring the second verse, I forgot to bring up this question. It says that God was moving over the face of the waters. Are we to assume that then the deep where the waters were in existence?
Well, we talked about that. We talked about creation out of nothing. This writer starts from the point where a lot of people in his world started, namely that everything was chaos at the beginning. Elsewhere in the Old Testament, I think in Proverbs 8, it suggests that God made the chaos. And in Hebrews, it makes it quite clear that God made everything, which would include the chaos. But he starts at the point where everybody knows their creation story, namely that at the beginning things were water. And you start from there. That was the starting point for all the stories in that world. So this writer simply is starting where everybody else starts. He's not raising the question of creation out of nothing, which we raise, or a creation of everything out of nothing. This question is answered elsewhere in Scripture, and it's implied already that in the beginning, in the first verse. But he's not talking about the farmer. He's talking about the fact that these are not God, and all the things that were made in the ordering of creation were made by God. Yes?
Do you think that this creation account was composed by one?
Genesis 1? Yes, I do. I think that he was aware of all these other stories, but I think Genesis 1 was created.
What are chances that you know that the oral
tradition would be earlier? Oh, oral tradition, that's another question. Yes, I'm sure that there is a back of it, an ordering of, that the stories came and handed down and down and down. Yes, I have no problem with that. Yes?
Well, kind of nice one to follow that.
Okay.
Do you think he went about this in the same way that contemporary writers might go about doing the whole stories or things, consolidating the story.
I think he goes about it. First of all, the man is a theologian. He's thinking in terms of relationship to God and the problem of his listeners. So he's writing to meet the need of his particular listeners. And if he were to take certain things in the past that were wrong, I think he says, well, a lot of people heard about the sea monster and the dragon. They were wrong on the concept of these things in the traditions that he may have received. And so he is correcting them, too, in that sense, yes, for the time of his audience, not for the 20th century science.
In the sense that he's presenting more correct concepts than the problem inspired. Is that...
Yeah, well, the sense that God was operating through this man is inspired. No question about that. Yeah. The question of inspiration doesn't mean that, you know, suddenly the guy gets a thunderbolt from the heaven and it's all laid out on a tablet. This man is operating in his world, and God operates through him in his world, just like he does with Paul or anybody else.
So the writer of this story is writing what, post-Exodus, post-exile?
Well, he's certainly writing as an Israelite of Israelites. We can keep it as broad as that at this moment without trying to pin it down.
But he knows this whole tradition too.
Yeah, he's not living in a vacuum, obviously. And the man is a very educated person. You look at the rest of the stuff that he wrote, he has, you know, an educated person. That's right. Israelites to Israelites. An Israelite to Israelites, for sure. Yeah.
With the sea monster, what does this include? I was just wondering whether you're talking about a dragon, or is there such a thing as a dragon exists? Or was there?
Well, there were dinosaurs and brontosauruses and a few other things, and I guess the traditions about huge animals came down. You know? Sure they did. As my poor boy said one day when we were talking about the flood, he says, Daddy, he says, you know, I have trouble with the flood. He was six at the time. I have trouble with the flood. I said, why do you have trouble with the story about the flood? He says, you know, Daddy, the teacher told us how big the ark was, and he said, if you put one brontosaurus in there, it would sink. Gee, it hit me between the eyes, you know. Two brontosauruses, two dinosaurs, two stegosauruses, and he goes down the list, you know, of all the animals that were, and he knows them all better than I do, and, you know, just sort of hits you between. It's fantastic. What do you do with this? What do you do with this whole business? You know, suddenly say, well, the thing is only a third as large as Queen Mary, the ship, the Queen Mary. And what do you do with this fantastic sudden discovery, you know, of the kid? He suddenly says, you know, it doesn't fit in. So a lot of these things suddenly are realizations that grow with you, that these stories are written from the limitations and the worldview and the situation of people. And you cannot be a 20th century person and transfer and make everything 20th century language. You have to go back and live in a world where they are, try and understand it, first of all, with their limitations and what they saw and did. Yes?
I realize this is trying to be science into it, but how did he happen to get the chronological order of animals right, and like the fishes and dinosaurs came from before the animals?
Well, how come did he do that? Well, how come did he do that? That's an interesting question. I suppose there's no reason why he shouldn't start with that. It followed the logical order of how he made the world. First of all, he made the sky and the waters. And so he had to have things to fill the sky and the waters. He doesn't start with the animals. He starts with the fish, the waters, and then the birds, and then the animals. That's right. And he ties it up with this, with his logical sequence of creation. And then I don't see why God couldn't, in his good disposition, want to let that stand, because it also happened to follow the order of the geologists' discoveries. But it's sort of fascinating that he doesn't follow that order in Genesis 2. Didn't work out that way everywhere in the Bible. It's not that neat. In a moment, we'll look at Genesis 2. I want to ask one other question. Here, we'll come to Genesis 2 in a moment. Here is the picture that we're talking about, where in his worldview he sees the waters as rain, meteorological, he explains the firmament, what we call space as firmament, and so on. We had a lot of these things. I've only got a couple on the board. Let me put one more.
When now, in his worldview, he's talking about what is an ordinary concept, a thing that's understandable to his people. If suddenly I put down here eon of 100 million years as the period for the creation of the animals, what would the poor Israelite do? I don't understand what you're talking about. But instead of putting eon, I put, well, a week of work for God. Is that an understandable concept for his life? God's week of work. And this is a normal span of work. And he uses the simple concept of the week as the span of time for the operation of creation. The Israel people around them always operate in the cycle of 12 months. The things happen annually. So he starts off with simply the week of work, 7 days. Now, should I then, if I don't press space, when I say firmament, if I don't press a number of these other things, well, what is above the heavens, and say there actually are floating up there, why should I press day when somebody says to me, it has to be 24 hours? Sure, it means 24 hours for the writer. There's no question about that in my mind. Morning and evening is one day. He means a week, a normal week of work. That's an understandable, simple concept that everybody could talk about. Why shouldn't he mean that? But does that necessarily mean that I am bound to it, any more than I am bound to believe that that sky is solid, like the Israelites believe? Or that there's waters up there, or any number of other things? Isn't it simply also part of his ordinary view of the world, an understandable term? Or does that create problems for you? Now somebody will say, well, I'm going to press the day because it's a one way of my fighting against the people for evolution. But the trouble is that the moment you start to press day in one point and say at this point it has to mean this scientifically and not theologically or poetically, then I'm going to have to press it in another passage or a couple of other passages, and then we really are in trouble. If I press it in Genesis 2 verse 4, then I've got to have the whole thing made on one day. If you press day there, it's just one day, you see. In the day God made the heavens and the earth, etc., etc., etc. And so my suggestion is, and you don't have to take this at all, you can throw the whole thing out the window and forget about everything I've said if you like. It doesn't bother me in the least. And you have a perfect prerogative to take the whole thing literally at every point and say, I'm going to mean solid thing. And I'm going to believe that the earth is the center of the universe and everything else. You can believe that. Doesn't matter. And you can say, day means 24 hours when God made it. But you also have to allow the right. If I can show that in a whole sequence of things, that this is the way people thought, and God used what their limitations were, their limit of knowledge, to communicate, that he would do the same thing when he talks about his week of work. You talk about 7 eons, in the sense of 100 million years or whatever one you want to call it, would be absolutely senseless to an Israelite. To even put the thing in a sequence of day, a week, rather than a sequence of a 12-month cycle, is already a departure from what everybody else around them was saying. Yes?
How can we make this type of thing relevant to our contemporary society when we are so conditioned this type of language is just the opposite of what we have been used to all the time? It seems that in Congress at this time to... It's almost impossible to ask to make this relevant to our contemporary society in the form of reference that would be...
How do you make the story relevant?
Yes.
Well, I think you make it relevant the way I've been talking here. Simply say, all right, what does it mean now? That God made everything. Come on, man, everywhere. God did it all. And God ordered it all. And so on, you see. But that you don't try and make it relevant in the same sense of saying, right, now I'm going to tell you a piece of science. That was the wrong way. I'm going to tell you some theology and what the theology means. We get to the creation of man, then it really becomes relevant. And that's a really a separate problem.
than trying to understand at this moment what it says exactly. Was there another question over here? Yeah.
Well, we've been separating scientists from theologian, and I talk now saying he wasn't speaking to the scientists.
He wasn't speaking to the scientists on scientists' terms.
But would he be considered, if we thought of a scientist as an informed critical thinker, as perhaps the informed critical thinker on the subject of, at the time?
At his day, yes. In his day, he was one who knew what was going on. In this sense, yes, in his day. But not in our day. Yes, that's right.
He's not ignoring.
No, he's not ignoring. He's making observations of the world around him like a scientist would do. But he's writing from the point of view of somebody who has to fight a theological or polemical battle, primarily. And so we have to be careful. But a scientist today, of course, has a message from this. Not the message of science that it gives him, but the message of theology, what God is doing. And that everything he has discovered is a discovery that God has put there for him. That God was excited about ordering things for the scientists to discover. So, and God had a lot of fun doing it. And as Cal said last night, you ain't seen nothing yet, which is a great line from God. All right, any more questions or we have to move on? What time is it? 6:15. That's not right. Something went wrong somewhere. What time is it now?
25 to 10.
It's going backwards. 25 to 10. All right. Well, we didn't get nearly as far as I thought today, but we can probably take Thursday to work this out. Let me give you one more thing. To help you understand that this whole thing is conditioned to some extent. In the story of the order of creation in Genesis 2. In Genesis 1, we have the setting to start with, which was chaos, the waters and everything else. Then we had the order of light. I'll just put these down quickly. 2 was firmament. 3 was earth, vegetation. 4 was sun, etc. 5 was fish, birds, and 6 was animals and man. Now what happens when the writer starts in Genesis 2? Just quickly, the question of the order, not about the rest of the meaning for it. We'll come to that tomorrow. What about the rest of Genesis 2? It starts off in Genesis 1 to 2, verses 4b. The first half is a close of chapter 1. These are generations of heaven and earth and so on. Then comes the second half. In the day, notice it begins in the same way. In the beginning, in the day. A kind of a introductory statement. In the day that God made the heavens and the earth. We haven't got any creation yet. Simply a description of the setting before God starts making anything. When there was no plant, there was no herb. God had not yet caused it to rain. There was no man. All there was a mist. And the trouble is, well, how do we translate this word mist? It only occurs twice in the whole Bible. And how can you tell how to translate a word? It only occurs twice in the Bible. How do you determine what a word means? Usage. If it's only used twice, you have problems. You don't have enough usage to determine exactly what it means. And in this case, the word mist, well, you could translate that, and a frog went up from the ground, or a spout went up from the ground, or a dragon went up. If you only got one word, how are you going to tell, if this occurs so rarely, what it means? And I think that the footnote there, which says flood or fountain, is probably as good a translation as mist. But anyway, something was coming out of the ground. That we know. And whatever comes out of the ground is more likely to be, rather than a mist, is likely to be a spout or a fountain anyway. And then verse 7, God starts to create. So we have the whole setting, first of all, the setting in verse 2-4 of, well, what? No water. There's no rain, at least. No what? Plants. And no man. This is pretty much what we would call a desert scene, right? That's the setting for the story of creation in Genesis 2, this phase of the creation story. When God made everything, this was the situation. After God made the heavens and the earth, this is assumed now. Then it was a scene of desolation. All right, now he starts creating. What does he make first? One.
Man.
Second. A garden, all right? The vegetation, you see? The vegetation gets made there. Now it was over here before. What comes next? Huh? Well, the trees are in the garden, the vegetation.
Rivers.
What next? Huh? Well, they were all there, it says. He didn't actually say he made. Animals, all right. And last but not least, of course. Huh? Woman. All right. It's a very interesting order, isn't it? Man, vegetation, water, animals, woman. It's not quite the same as Genesis 1, is it? Not quite. I think that sort of says something about the importance of the order, which you were saying, is nicely fitting according to science. It says something about the ordering of your creation story. Which one are you going to pick as being the right one, scientifically? Huh? If you pick this one, I'll pick that one, if you're going to start fighting about it. See? And there's another one of those things that is typical. You can look at Proverbs 8 and Psalm 104 and look at other variations in this ordering. They're not quite the same each time. And there are other things in the order in other places as well. Very careful boundaries are drawn someplace. So it would suggest that just like the day and the firmament and these other things, the order of creation and these things are things that are governed by the need of the writer and the situation and what they could understand and what the problem was, rather than by what we would call the neat patterns of science. You see, the scientific explanation of the ordering of things, which would be according to certain geological, biological, and similar processes. Certainly, man was created, came to be at the same time that woman came to be, scientifically. I hope so. Would seem that way. And a few other things, too. So that is another little hint of the fact that you better be careful when you start pressing science in connection with the Genesis story. And I could find a few other things, but this will be enough for today. Yes, dear?
Do we know who wrote Genesis? The name of man or anything?
Does it tell us anywhere in Genesis who wrote the book? Does it say in the book of Genesis who wrote it? Where did you say? Where does it say that?
My book says, the top, the first book of Moses, commonly called Genesis. But if you look at the Hebrew Bible, what will it say? It will say, in the beginning. The first book of Moses, commonly called Genesis, is a title that was put in umpteen years later in the time of Luther in the Middle Ages. It's never there. That's not part of the text. You look at the Hebrew Bible, and I by chance have looked at it, and the title is in the beginning. The title of each of the books of Genesis is the first three words of that book, or the first word, or first or second word. So the title of Genesis is Bereshit Bara, not the first book of Moses. And it nowhere in the text of the book says anything about Moses. He's never mentioned by name or anything else.
So if you're going to say Moses wrote it, you have to depend not upon the statement of the book, but upon some kind of external, some kind of testimony from elsewhere. And the only other testimony that you could use, perhaps, is the testimony of the New Testament. You can't find it in the book itself. If you can find it, you're a better man than I am. You can get in. Yes? Do we have any idea what it's written? Well, now the question is, we talked about this the other day. We have a piece of literature. Say in the ancient world, and this man was talking about oral tradition, if you come to write a book in the ancient world,
Should we assume automatically the same kind of process as today,
where a man sits down, he gets his research and he writes it, and you put a date, 1965? Could we even assume that the thing was written in 1 year or at one sitting? Is it possible that this book is a compilation of writings of different people even? Should we just assume that it was just written by one man? Why should we assume that thing? Even the book of Jeremiah, which we talked about the other day, we know for sure, we said, that it wasn't written just by Jeremiah. How did we know that? Who remembers? The last chapter, chapter 51, says, so far the words of Jeremiah. Then we get chapter 52. And where did we find chapter 52? In the book of Kings. Obviously, that wasn't written by Jeremiah, and it's in the style of the book of Kings, not in the style of Jeremiah. So no reason to assume that he wrote it. And so you have to... Why should we assume? Our technique of writing, where one man sits down and writes a book. Maybe that happened sometimes. I'm sure it did. But it didn't necessarily always happen. And so sometimes we ought to ask the question whether or not Genesis was always written by one person. Actually, originally I had planned about having a lecture upon the possibility of, you know, of all the different possible materials in the Pentateuch, you know, the different periods when it was possibly written. But I thought that maybe we'd get a little bit obtuse and I would get down to the concrete things about firmaments and waters and all the rest of it. Do I answer your question partly? Yeah, you still haven't said when. Well, then you're very bright. Most of the people that I talk to in Bible classes have never even thought about that question. The probable date for the Genesis, most scholars would say that Genesis 1 was written last, after Genesis 2. That it was part of the introduction to the book of Genesis that he put in. And the superstructure of 10 that we talked about yesterday is the last man's organizing of the material. I'm giving you the most commonly accepted understanding of that fact now. And that this was finally put together by the time of the exile. Whereas Genesis 2 was considerably earlier, perhaps even as early as the time of David. This is what scholars are saying. To give you the evidence for or against those positions, I would have to go into a lot of other questions, which at this point I wasn't planning to raise. But they are, I could if you wanted to spend the time. And I think maybe a little far out. Yes.
Why are you talking about
that Bible is him. Oh, yes.
Right under the title of the book, it says, year before the common year of Christ, 4004, cycle of the moon, 7, conviction, 5, creation from September 1st.
That's right. September 1st. We're almost right at New Year's Day. September 1st, 4004 B.C. That's the date of creation. Now, you see, if you start being literal, you can press the literal facts to precisely that moment. How do you get that? You go back with all the ages of the patriarchs, which we said were in neat patterns of 10, you remember, the other day. You follow all their ages back, the kings, the patriarchs, and you get back, according to a guy by the name of Bishop Usher, who has plagued us ever since, with the date of 4004 B.C., September 1st. 6:45 a.m. or something like that. And there it is. There it is. And this is really not humorous for many people who have been brought up in precisely this kind of tight reckoning with figures and numbers and concepts. And they have operated from the 20th century and said, things have to be precisely this way. If I cannot trust the date or the number of patriarchs there, then I can't trust anything else in the Bible. The problem is that they got their faith grounded in words instead of the Word, which is Jesus Christ. And any modifications of how they had once been taught what a verse meant or a word meant disturbs their faith. Faith is not grounded in whether or not it is 24 hours or not 24 hours, obviously. It's grounded in the fact that Christ died for me and I trust in Him. It is person to person, not person to a couple of words. Even though it is through those words that we often come to know. Yes.
How
would this man explain geological findings that dated back 10 billion years or 10 million years?
He didn't believe in geological time.
And that's proven back in modern times.
Well, you don't have to believe that. You don't have to believe anything Dr. Edmund said. But I suggest that it's worth listening to him. He's going to talk about geological time today. He didn't get on it yesterday, did he? He's going to discuss geological time, and it'll fit in exactly with this. And is Dr. Edmund here now? No. I didn't expect him to come and listen to me twice. He's heard this. And he's sick of my spouting. But Dr. Edmund is actually a fantastic man. When I first heard him, the first lecture, I thought, well, he's a typical professor. But I listened to him again. I listened to him again. And I got to know him. And then I listened to him again. And the more I listen to him, the further he gets up there on a pedestal, far above what I am as a person. This man is just great. And tomorrow night, after Vespers, one of the things that I'm going to do, a number of isolated things that will hang together. One is a little dramatic thing. And also one is a poem, which I have written in honor of Dr. Edmund, through whom I have learned a lot in these last weeks. So I suggest, if you are not ready to listen to him, you ought to. This man has a fantastic ability to just give of himself. I can't describe what I learned of that one man in such a short time. He would loan you the soles of his feet. Just unbelievable. Anyway, you'll get the feel of it when I read the poem. It's in his honor, and in a certain sense, it's a poem that will fit the ideal man that you ought to be moving towards as a man in God in many ways. Because I get all excited and jump around. And never. And he catches a fish, he goes there and we go fishing together. He will throw his line and, while I'm getting mine untangled for the 14th time, he's got his 14th fish, 12, that's the limit, all right.